Peter's day about salvation. It was not done through what they did by keeping the Old Testament, the 576 rules in the New Testament that were required. What God has done is he has acted out of mercy. We didn't deserve any kindness from God. We didn't deserve his salvation. But God acted in mercy. Now the third point about the salvation is that it is a new birth. In fact, the only way you can describe what God has done for us, he's not made us better, although that's true. He has not made good men, bad men good, and good made better. The only way to describe what God has done for us is new birth. A whole new start. A totally different way of living. It's the only way the writers to the New Testament describe it. We start with a new birth. The old things disappear. The new has come. So what's this great salvation that God has achieved for us that we say kudos? The first one is the living hope. Now, there was a man called Werner Frank, was an internee in a Nazi concentration camp. At the end of the war, he was released, and he went on to become a psychiatrist. He wrote a book about his experiences in the camp. And he said there were people in the camp who all of a sudden would just lie down. It doesn't matter whether it was in the lineup to get fed, when they slept, they just didn't bother to get up, or sometimes in the middle of the square in the center of the camp, they just laid down. And it doesn't matter how much the guards beat them. It didn't matter how much they set the dogs on them. Those people would not get up. And he analyzed the situation and said those people had lost hope. They thought that there was no way that this concentration camp was going to end. The Nazis were going to lose the war, and they would be liberated by either the Americans or the British or the Russians. And because they saw no end in what they had, they lost hope. And they just lay on the floor and died. Now he said there was another group in the camp. And although they didn't go around the camp with a smile, you could tell from their faces that there was a determination in them. They looked and they thought, we are going to survive this. This will not last forever. One day it will be over and we'll be able to go back to our normal living. And they were determined that they were going to do it. And they had hope, writes Werner Frank, that the end will come of this terrible nightmare of the concentration camp. They would be liberated. They would be free. They could go back to their homes and meet their loved ones once again. And they walked around the camp, not briskly, not quickly, but with a kind of determination. They had hope. And Werner Frank says the people who had no hope gave up and died. The people who had hope lived, and they were determined that one day this nightmare will end, and they will go back to normal. And I think that's the meaning of the text here. Live in hope. It's a hope that causes us to live. We live in times where there is darkness. Let's be fair. COVID-19 is running rampant. One of my ex-colleagues at the lab, his wife is a respirologist, that is a doctor that specializes in respiratory diseases. So she's in the ICU right now, dealing with people who have COVID-19. Every shift she is on, someone is taken out because they have passed away. She's never experienced anything like it in her life. And we look and say, is this ever going to end? Are we ever going to go back to normal? Is anything going to be the same as it was before? Or it may be different, but the person who has hope, a hope that helps them to live, will get through this. The person who looks and says, oh, it's bad, it's terrible, it's never going to end, why don't I just call it quits right now? They're not going to survive. What's been interesting, the Lord's never mentioned on the news, is how many suicides, how much suicide has increased with COVID-19. It's a substantial increase. And the reason the psychiatrists say is because people lose hope that this COVID-19 is never going to end. Just like the people in the concentration camp thought it would never end. Peter comes to us and writes and says, God has given us a hope that helps us to live. And that's a tremendous gift from God. And we say kudos to God for giving us that hope that helps us to live. Now the second part, he has given us an inheritance. And there are two parts to this. The first part is that this inheritance never fades. It never spoils. It never disintegrates. Now, to understand what that meant in time Paul is writing, when you gave someone their inheritance, most of the time, it was in the form of clothes or a material. That was what you gave your kids as an inheritance. Now, you realize right away there are a couple of problems. First of all, it meant that the styles did not change from one generation to another. Would ever think that you'd wear your mother's clothes? What were your grandchildren that would look and say, this is what my inheritance is? A pile of your clothes? No, they had a totally different view. Cloth, especially the cloth that was used for inheritance, was very expensive to buy. And so as they looked at this inheritance, cloth fades. Over time, the colors in cloth they're not as bright as they were when the cloth was made. And Peter writes, this inheritance will not fade. Unlike the garments you've got or the cloth you've got for your earthly inheritance here, the inheritance that God has provided for you will never fade. Spoiling. Obviously, you know that when you leave cloth out, it spoils because along come the moths and they eat it. And so what could be a beautiful garment at one stage or beautiful cloth, when the moths come, they destroy it. And so Paul writes, that inheritance for you will never spoil. In fact, he's really quoting directly from Jesus, but in slightly different words. Jesus says, lay up for yourself treasure in heaven, where moth and rust do not corrupt, and thieves do not break in and steal. So here is this inheritance that God has given us. That is in heaven that will never spoil, never fade. Now the second thing about it is that it is inheritance that can't be taken away. It's reserved in heaven for you. It has your name on it. Bill's, Fred's, Gloria's, Maxine's. It's reserved by God in heaven for you and for you alone. Now, in contrast to that, we were traveling in the Okanagan one day a few years ago, and we saw this huge, and I mean huge, motorhome. It is the biggest motorhome I've ever seen in my life. Gigantic. And at the back of it, there was a bumper sticker. We are spending our children's inheritance. Now, we don't need to worry about that with the inheritance that God has provided. He has set it aside for us. The next phrase, shielded by God's power. Now, there are two crises in Canada going on right now. The first crisis is the opioid crisis. And you may not see much of it in Westlaw. We don't see so much in Edmonton. But in places like Vancouver, it is huge. Huge. Someone we know is a paramedic in Vancouver. There are some evenings where she is called out three times in an evening to the same person. They administer the antidote. The person wakes up, walks around, is living again, promptly takes another dose requiring the antidote. And the reason it's increasing is because with the closure of the Canadian-US border, people can't smuggle drugs across as easy as they used to. So what these people are taking is pure rubbish. It's not the drug at all. Now, where did this crisis develop? Well, opioids are a drug that is given, or a class of drug that is given for pain. When Tylenol just doesn't work anymore, for example, if you've had hip surgery, if you've had opioids are quite commonly given. And so what happens is, more than often, people take opioids to relieve their pain, which is legitimate, but they become addicted to it, and they need it. And so they spend the money that should be spent on groceries and other things on drugs. Now, the second great crisis, obviously, is COVID-19. And it's just sweeping through us. And I look at this text, and I say, we are shielded by God's power. Are we protected from opioid crisis? I would suggest that if you went among the drug addicts of Vancouver, you would find no Christians there. I suspect that you would find no people who were brought up in Christian homes that had some Christian training. And I think people are protected, shielded by God against some of the worst ravages that go on in our world. So let me stop a moment. Does that mean that I can go around masking, not without a mask? Does that mean that I can go right up to somebody that I don't have to socially distance anymore? Does it mean that I can go to the rodeo in Bowden with 2,500 people? Or to a wedding nearby where there were 250 people, not wear a mask? God's protecting me. Rubbish. God expects you to follow the approved guidelines that are there to protect you. And so don't turn around and say, oh, God's going to shield me from COVID-19 because I'm a Christian. I don't need to follow any of the rules. God gave you smarts. God gave you intelligence. And he expects you to follow the rules. Now let's look at the next one. There is a difference in our perspective of persecution. At the time Peter wrote his letter, the Emperor Nero was on the throne. And Nero was a certifiable crazy. The only tune book he sang off was the Looney Tunes songbook. When Rome burnt, he played his lute, kind of instrument with five or six strings. He played his lute and sang as it burnt. Now, he was the one that started the fire. But he blamed the Christians. And so he developed this very unusual punishment. In the Circus Maximus, the racing track, to run at night, they needed lights. So what he did was put the Christians in oil, put them on the light stand poles, light them on fire, and that provided the light for the horse racing that night. That's why in chapter 2 Peter, it talks about the fiery trials that you are coming about. These are people under huge persecution. Now, the emperor that came after Nero was even more of a crazier than Nero. He was completely crazy. His name was Domitian. And when he got annoyed or just down a little bit, what he would do is say, bring the Christians into the arena. So they would put a group of Christians in the center of the arena. They would open the gates and out would come hungry wild animals. And Domitian would sit in the stands and watch. He went away puzzled. And every time he had that performance, he went away puzzled. Because those Christians that he was putting in the arena did not run away when the wild animals came into the ring. They kind of went together and held one another. And the majority of them had smiles on their faces. And Domitian was completely puzzled why people who were about to be eaten with wild animals had smiles on their faces. And it doesn't matter how many times he saw those acts of cruelty, every time he said people had smiles on their faces. He couldn't reconcile it. So the people of 1 Peter that Peter is writing to are under tremendous persecution. So why persecution? Well, there's first of all two reasons why. Persecution makes us better Christians. Peter says, the trial of your faith, if we compare it with gold, gold is precious. Gold never corrupts. Now here we need to stop. Gold this week was trading at $2,222 an ounce. Now, it's not the ounce that you use to cook or to bake. It's a special ounce. And if you take four toonies and put them together, that's the ounce used in terms of gold. So four toonies put together is the same as 1 ounce of gold. 1 ounce of gold is worth $2,222. And so when you ever put four toonies together, look and say, hey, this is like 1 ounce of gold. But Peter comes back and says, you know what? Your Christian faith is more precious than gold. It's more precious than $2,222 an ounce. Your faith is much more valuable than gold. So he says, yes, you may be under persecution. You may be under tremendous pressure to give up your Christian faith. But remember this, your faith is more precious than gold. The second thing he says is that it survives longer than gold. Now, to a chemist like myself, gold belongs to a class of metals called the precious metals. And the unusual thing about this group is how stable they are. If you put gold out and it rained, well, it doesn't destroy like iron. In fact, archaeologists have found where they dig in, they have found ornaments made of gold that look exactly the same as the day they were made. They don't deteriorate. They don't rot. They don't fade. They don't change. And Peter comes now and says, listen, guys, gold never is destroyed. It never changes. But your Christian faith is much more indestructible than gold, which perishes. Now, come on, Peter, your metallurgy is terrible. Gold doesn't perish. Ah, says Peter, but your Christian faith will never perish either. So that Christian faith you have, we have a different worldview of it. Yes, it's persecution. Yes, it's not nice to go through. But the persecution that Christians go through is to make their faith, which is more precious than gold to start off with, even more precious. It is such that the length of time that it looks good. For gold, yes, it's a long time in several centuries, but your Christian faith never changes, never perishes. The next one I'd like to talk about a little bit is our different attitude to Jesus. Peter writes, whom having not seen, you love. In whom you have not seen, you believe. And because you do that, you have this inexpressible joy living within you. Now, Diane and I have often discussed in these last whiles, how do you meet someone at COVID times? You go out for coffee, and because you're not in the same household, you can't sit at the same table. You're not supposed to hug. So if you're going out with a girl, how do you get to know her without hugging her? It's a whole new world of courtship. Of course it is. It's different. But, says Peter, you have never seen Jesus. You've never hugged Jesus. You've never sat down and had a cup of coffee with Jesus. But you love him. Totally different. It's almost like a male romance. You don't see him, but you love him. The second one is you don't see him, but you believe in him. The Western society is very much a show-me society. You have to see it to believe it. Show me. In fact, there's one state in the United States called the show-me state because they're skeptical about anything unless they're shown it. And so Peter writes that here you are, you have not seen Jesus, but you believe in him. You believe that he died for you upon the cross. You believe that he rose from the dead. And those two things together make it such that you are filled with inexpressible joy. It can't be defined. It can't be narrowed down. So does that mean as Christians we go around with happy smiles on our faces? No. Joy is something from within. Not that something that comes across in smiles. Yes, it does come across in smiles, but we don't go around looking crazy and smiling all the time and smirking all the time. The joy that we have is inside. Now, what is our end goal in life? Why are we here and what are we expecting down the road? Peter says the end goal of life, the end goal particularly of the Christian life, is the salvation of your souls. So salvation has a couple of meanings and a couple of thoughts. When a person is saved, they are unable, they're in the middle of a disaster. For example, if they're on a lake and they don't swim and the boat capsizes, here is a situation that is an absolute catastrophe. The second thing about salvation is that you can't help yourself. Because in the case of the boat, for example, you can't swim. So you can't save yourself. And the only way you're going to get saved is by an external force coming and helping you. Now that's the word that's used in Christianity, about what it is to be a Christian. You are described as being saved. So let's go through that three steps. The first step is that we are in a situation where we can't help ourselves. We fall short of God's standards. We're unable to bring ourselves up to God's standards by doing. We are in a perilous place, a disaster. The second phase is that we're unable to help ourselves. No matter what we do, how many times we go to church, or how many times we read the Bible, we are unable to help ourselves out of this perilous situation. And so the last one, that someone from the outside rescues us. And that's God, who has sent his son Jesus Christ into the world. Then he died upon a cross and he rose again from the dead. And that external force is the only thing that can save you. And so as Christians, we look forward to the day when we will fully experience our salvation through Jesus Christ. And if you're not a Christian, if you've never made that commitment, let me tell you, you're in a disastrous situation. You can't help yourself. And only God is able to do something about it. Because his son Jesus has died upon a cross and has risen from the dead. Let's pray. Father, we thank you this morning for your word. There is so much in this passage. And to be honest with you, I feel that I've just skimmed through it. There is so much here. So we would ask that the meditation of our hearts and the words of our lips might go into people's ears and people's hearts, that they may respond to this message of hope, of mercy, of goodness, of kindness, of loving you, and that they may experience the salvation of their souls, that they may come to know you as Lord and Savior.